It's 8:31, so let us start. It is the 26th of October, 2020. This is actually the 247th class. It'll be 200, well, class and lecture. And if you go on the Torah in Motion website under podcasts and you plug in my name, it'll show 246. So right. We're coming up to, we maybe for 250, we should do something.
248, Mitzvah Aseh, next week. We do a
next
party
week, for right. Mitzvah Aseh. Okay. Everyone, okay, let me begin because there's a lot to get to and even before we begin the class. And I want to, we have to return to last week because important things were said. Actually, before we ended, and this doesn't appear on the YouTube or on the podcast, I threw out something. So let me just clarify it because people emailed me about it. Rabbi Kelman said, Laila Tov. So I just threw out about the Vilna Gaon. If you look in he would say maybe Tova. If you look in the Vilna Gaon's commentary, I'm holding it right now to the Seder, Passover Seder. He asked the question. It says, Manishtana Halaila Hazeh. And he wants to know, he says, Laila's Nekeva. So therefore he says, Tsarich Lichtov tell me that it's a Laila Zot. Why does it say Manishtana Halaila Hazeh? It should say Manishtana Halaila Hazot. And he goes, he actually gives a Kabbalistic explanation. Incidentally, he's not the only one to say this. The Shlah also says this, but it's a problem because Laila appears numerous times, Lael, in Tanakh, and it's always masculine. This has even led some people, the Torah Tamima, Ramashulam Roth, and others, to say that it can't really be said by the Vilna Gaon. It must be a Talmud Torah, a mistaken student, because the commentary was not put together by the Gaon, it was put together by students of his. I was sympathetic to this for a little while, but then once on a Shabbos, when I lived in Manhattan in the Ridnicker Shul, if anyone knows that shul, right, Orenstein shul, his son-in-law was there, and his son-in-law from Lakewood is a big, I don't know, I don't remember his name. Maybe someone listening knows the name. He's a big expert on the Vilna Gaon, and he says it's absolutely authentic. Now, how the Gaon could have said it, I don't know, but he does say it. Actually, the Rambam sometimes makes this a mistake. The Rambam, a few times in the Mishnah Torah, including, I'll just give you one if you want to check it, Hilchos Talmud Torah, Perek Gimel, Halacha Yud Gimel, treats Laila as feminine. He says that you should stay up at night and study. He says, Yisar b'chol el-tav, v'lo yavar afilu, don't even miss achat mehen, b'shein av achil o'shniya. He says, don't even miss one night. Achat, not echat, achat. And that's how it appears in all the manuscripts, although it was corrected in the printed version. But that would be a slip of the pen, perhaps. The Rambam's writing quickly. I don't think he assumed Laila's like some words that go feminine and masculine, Bayit and others. But the Gra asked the question. You can check it out. And no one knows what to make of that at all, that Laila, he thinks Laila is feminine. Yes, yeah, sure, Susanna, Laila is always masculine. It's masculine every single time. The problem is the Vilna Gaon thinks it's feminine. He wants to know why it says Manishtana Laila Hazeh. We already spoke about the word Zo or Zot. So it's a big problem with the Vilna Gaon. And the Vilna Gaon is not some Ashkenazi who doesn't know Diktuk. The Vilna Gaon wrote a whole book, Diktuk Eliyahu. He's an expert on Diktuk, and he has all the rules. So I don't know what to make of that. If anyone knows, you can let me know. I was able to read a little more in that kuntras that Rabbi Leib sent me by the rabbi in Israel about how to pick... how to decide Pesach. I'm happy to send to anyone. I mean, he quotes all the sources, the Rishonim, he quotes the Rashba. He said the Rashba that if you have two poskim, one says Usher, one says Mutter, if they're both equivalent, you can pick which one you want. But then, and he goes through all the different sources, but then he speaks about how we're in a new era today because now we have computers and we have all the books. And he raises the question of what's the point of asking a Pesach? Because he assumes something which I found questionable. He assumes that if you know that most, let's it's a Doraisa, and most poskim hold it's Usser, you have to go a Chumrah. The reason I find that difficult is because our tradition doesn't seem to be like that. If Moshe Feinstein, you know, the Posek Ador says, is Mekil on even a Doraisa, we assumed, at least I thought we assumed, you can go like him. But he says, what's the point of asking any Shilas? Because he says, let's say you know from your reading, let's say it's a Durabanan, and most of them are Mekil. So what's the point of asking? And if it's a Doraisa, And most poskim are machmir. What's the point of asking, let's say, Rabbi Williger, or Herschel Schefter, or Asher Weiss, or anything? He says, because no matter what they say, it's still the majority whole, and it's still a d'oraisa, and the majority holds it's l'chumra, so you should go l'chumra. And he, it's a very interesting question he raises, and he doesn't really give an answer. He says, im yadua shehu nido d'oraisa v'yesh bazadeos bein poskim. So in other words, if you know, we raised this question last week, if you read an article online and you see that most people hold one way, most people say are machmir, what's the point? There's no reason to ask a shayla, he says, because even if the Rav holds is a mekel, you still have to be a machmir. He's basically claiming that the knowledge we all have today based on line and story means you don't need to ask these questions. You don't need to ask a shayla. Many people think you need to ask a shayla. His position is you don't need to. What do I need to ask my local Rav shayla? I can investigate it, and I see that the majority go one way. I can hold like them in a derabanan. I have to hold like them in a derais and a derabanan. Different situation. And finally, he quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, an amazing thing in Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's Mincha Shlomo. He says that this even binds the poskim. He says that Rav Shlomo Zalman held that if I, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, hold that it's usser and it's a derabanan, and I know that the majority are makil on it, if someone asks me the shayla, I, the posek, even though I hold it's usser in a derabanan, I have to tell the person that it's mutter because the majority disagree with me. I've never heard a thing like this, but Rav Shlomo Zalman says it, that even the posek himself has to answer based by the majority, and if unless it says Talmud Mufak. So there's all sorts of discussions. I can send it to anyone. Oh, last week we spoke about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I was sent the video, and I thanked the person who sent me, and I thought this was the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I'll pull it up for you again. I thought it was the Lubavitcher Rebbe reading the Megillah. Thing here. I have so many pages open. Here we are. Now, part of the problem is also that if you look carefully, the Rebbe is reciting the bracha. Has anyone ever seen a case where someone recites the bracha? On the contrary, you're not supposed to recite the bracha, at least we were told you not to. Rabbi Isaac Rice even sent me that a page in which it quotes the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, which says explicitly in Siman Reish Yud Gimel, if among everyone they're doing one mitzvah, Echem Avarech Kulam, the Ein Rishayim Avarech Chol Atzmo. One bracha is made, and you can't make your own bracha. So I was very surprised. I thought it was the Rebbe because I see him making a bracha. Here he is.
Baruch Ato Adonai Eliheinu Melech Ha'ilom אשר קידישנו במצווי צום, וציוונו על מקרא מגילה.
Well, it's not him, and I heard you, sorry, from Baruch, from Shul last week. I'm like everyone else. I'm not a Chabadnik. I saw the video. I thought it was. It's the Baal Koreh's Rebbetzin Shusterman. He was the Baal Koreh of the Megillah, and he also read Torah in Shul, and he's also the person. So now I'm not upset with saying that he's wrong on the issue of Vayehi, because it's one thing to say about the Rebbe, but it's Ramatul Schusterman, and I listen more on the Megillah, and he's like an Ashkenazic Baal Koreh. He's not Makpid on many things. For example, he doesn't say Hamdinos, he says Hamdinos. He doesn't get Ritzafat right. Okay. In general, Ashkenazim have not been so makpid. In Chabad, I always hear, but it's not just Chabad; it's all Hasidic. In Kaddish, for instance, they don't. They always say Yiskadol v'Yiskadash. Let's have Yiskadal. So, I thank Mel also for sending me some things on this. All of you, I'll get to all the things, if not in future classes. All the comments you sent, I can't get to everything, but Mel points out correctly with the simanim tikkun, there's no reason why we can't all be more exacting on this. When I said last week I wasn't so exacting, if I had 6 months to repair, it's one thing, but with these backyard minyanim, we don't have much time, we have a week or two. So if I'm stuck and, either I'm going to get a perfect aliyah with all the shva non shva nachs, or I'm going to finish it, I'd rather finish it, because most of them, it's just extra, it's nice. But if you say Vishamru, Visham, or you say Vishamaru with the Shva Na under the Mem, it really doesn't matter. I thank Shemar, Nachum Shemayahu for telling me who the reader was, although he says that in Chabad, no one knows why the Rebbe would recite it out loud, the bracha. Okay. Two more things. I listened to the talk last week that I gave, and I see I wasn't clear when I was quoting this book, who I can't reveal who wrote it, about the two children. It hasn't been edited properly. I'm reading it, and I'm saying there's a pasuk in the Torah, "Odata levanecha." There's no such pasuk. What the Yaakov Kamenetsky's point was that he got it to levincha. The Torah says your children, you have to tell them what to do. So if the grandchildren, you're not responsible. If they want to give two names, that's okay. And I read just one more thing. I can't resist. In this book, it says that once Rav Aaron Cutler came, when Aaron Cutler was in Eretz Yisrael, he came with a student to visit the Ger Rebbe. And the Ger Rebbe would give out peros to his Hasidim, fruit. And the Rebbe wanted to give a fruit to the student, but the student refused, saying he wasn't hungry. So what Anna HaRebbe, the Rebbe replied, "Hineni roesh shelo tiyeh chassid. I see that you're not taking the fruit. You're not going to be a chassid." Yes, Alan, it's Vishamaru. I understand. That's for him. "You're not going to be a chassid." So Rav Aaron says after he left, "Harei hayakadai lisamei America lekabel bracha zo shelo tiyeh chassid." He says, it was worth coming all the way from America to go to Israel to get a bracha that you won't become a chassid. That's what it's. This is the sort of book, if it's ever published, it's not going to be banned. And if you knew who wrote it, we're talking a very well-known rabbi. The last thing I want to get to, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to, the other ones I'm going to put on the floor now. I will get to you next class. Hyman, I'll get to you. I'll get to Mel. I'll get to Yehuda Schneider, etc. So let me just show you this, and then we begin with my son. So this will take us to like 8:45. Let me share the screen here again. And this will be the last thing we deal with, this matters of grammatical things. Some people love it, but others don't care. My son, as I said last week, two things. I want to show you the mistake that Ashkenazim will make and what my son emailed me. He was reading the Torah in Parshas Bereishis, and he wanted to do Shvanaz and Shvana, and he wanted to do the different kamatzes. Ashkenazim basically, like Yemenites, pronounce all kamatzes like aw. Kamatz katan, kamatz gadol, with one exception, kol. We'll get to that in a second. We pronounce like a cholam. But if you're a Sfardi and you pronounce everything ah, so then you pronounce it oh. Like you wouldn't say chochma, you'd say chochma. So my son had a problem because he's afraid that they were going to correct him. And I'll show you the examples in particular, what he was afraid of, how he should have pronounced it. So you see here, let's see, verse chaf dalet, you see it, 24. Al Kane, what do you say? Yazavish? I can tell you that a lot of people pronounce it. We're talking about people who say the Sephardic pronunciation, Yazavish. It's not Yazav. That's right. So here you can hear, I'll pull up for you. You listen to Rabbi Weider.
Vayomer Odom Zos Hapam Etzem Meatzamai Uvosor Mibisari Lizos Yikare Isha Kimeish Lokhos Zos Alken Yazov Ish Esoviv Esimo.
And he had similar examples, but I don't know what he did. I have to ask him. I thought he'd be nervous. So, for example, how do you end this, the Aliyah? The Asar and Iohim Adam Lishto, cut note or? No, it's coat. That's how it's pronounced. Or similarly, here in above, in Pasuk Ki Biyom, is it Achalchem or Acholchem? And that's how you pronounce it. So that's the first thing. If you're a Sfardi, if you're an Ashkenazi, it's okay. But there is one final issue before we begin what we're supposed to do today, I want to point out to you. And that is in the word kol. There's an inconsistency because we, if you look in Tanakh, kol has the hyphen. So we, without the hyphen, it's kaf with the cholem and it's lamed kol. Even with, so when it does, when it has the hyphen, it's connected and has the kamatz, it's a kamatz katan, even Ashkenazim, unless maybe in the Washington Heights community, it's differently. I've never heard anyone say kol. It's always kol. But in a prayer that we say every single Shabbos, you have one of the two examples where the word appears with the kamatz and there's no hyphen and it's actually a kamatz gadol. So for the Ashkenazim, we should not be pronouncing it kol, we should say kol. And Sfardim have to pronounce it kal, but all the Ashkenazim who grow up speaking Sfardic, they always get it wrong. And what am I referring to here? And then I'm gonna, and the Sfardim all get it right. If you see my cursor, it says Nishmas. Ki chol pel acha yodeh, v'chol lashon acha tishabeach. Where are we? So over here. Shneamar, it's not kol atzmotai tomarna. It's kal. That's how it is. And I know people will think you're crazy and correct you, but all the Sfaradim get it right because they pronounce it. So here, pay attention. Here's I just pulled up a Moroccan.
בכל ברך לך תכרע, בכל קומה לפניך תשתחווה, והלבבות יראוך, בכל קרב וכליות יזמרו לשמך, כדבר שנאמר, קל עצמותי תאמר אדוני מיכה.
So you all heard it there, קל. And that's how it's pronounced. Why that is the case, maybe another time, but this isn't a talk on grammar, but I like it. So I didn't used to not like it. I didn't used to like it. I'll explain in a few classes how I got into all this. But now we return to the book, Igros Malchei Rabbanan. We're picking up on page Reish, Siman Pei Zayin with Vishoma Zaman Arbach. We ended, we're going to continue with Ramanasha Klein, because he split up into different tshuvot, what originally was one tshuvah to me. Two of you asked me, you didn't understand Ramanasha Klein going off all against English Torah writings. What about the Rambam of Sadia Go? And I said last week, maybe I didn't say it, I said I certainly said it the week before, that those were written in Hebrew script. So even though they were written in Arabic, it's Hebrew script. That's not a problem because that's a Jewish language. Non-Jews can't read it. But in the vernacular, when you actually write it so that everyone, the non-Jews, could see it, that's the problem. The Rambam even wrote halachic writings. The commentary on the Mishnah and the Sefer HaMitzvot were in Arabic. And we have other halachic writings in Arabic. But if you recall, last class we ended with this Rabbi Nachman Stepansky, or Stepansky, in Siman Pei Zayin, where the important thing was he spoke about the necessity for Shlomo Zalman. In his book, he cited, I saw in his book, we spoke about the book, where he was asked, this is volume one, page 236, can a yeshiva bacher not go home and light the Hanukkah candle with his wife? Can he just stay in the yeshiva? And she lights it by herself. Rav Shlomo Zalman said, "Me'ikar Adin, yes, she can light for you." But he says that's not mekubal, and he doesn't think it should be done. And he says, for every matter, you have to think with the seichel, but also with the regish. How's your wife going to feel if you leave her to light the candles? And so I wrote to him asking, are there other examples in your book in which you? Because I had seen them. I had seen them. I just wanted to know where they were. Where Rav Shlomo Zalman says you have to deal with the regesh. And he cites a number of examples where Rav Shlomo Zalman says that in deciding matters, it can't just be intellectual. You have to, it's also how you feel it. He gives things that are even maybe you wouldn't expect it. Like, do you make a bracha on, he was asked Shachayanu on a new Sefer Torah. And he says, Zetalei beregesh. It's how you feel. If you feel so overwhelmed with it, but if already you know it's your third Sefer Torah, you don't need to. He also asked about seeing the bracha Osem Asebreshi, if you see Mount Hermon. Again, it has to do with Regesh. And he gives other examples. He says, he asks them, what's the Gedra Isser Shok V'Kal Srosh V'Ishto Nida? Woman Nida, how, what's considered slope? You're just supposed to avoid. And he says, Kvar Targish, Yodimit. You'll know. In other words, not everything can you put into writing. There's room for feeling. And then Rabbi Stefanski goes on to explain that this matter of regish, feeling and deciding halacha, he thinks this is one of the most important things that many people, because he says our Torah is a Torah Chaim, a Torah of life that includes all of life, including the regish. And how could you consider that this wouldn't be important? But he says there are many, even Talmidei Chachamim, who don't understand this, who think that a posek is just like a computer and the feeling, the personal sense. I have to say that you can read writings like Rav Soloveitcher's Halachic Man and come away feeling exactly that's, it's like Spock, you know, with no emotion. But already at the beginning of Halachic Man, the Rav says that this is like a theoretical creation. It's like economic man. And the Rav, in reality, as a posek, wasn't like that. He himself says that in certain areas, I've mentioned this a few times in his famous letter about being a chaplain in the army, he says from the very beginning that I'm inclined in a certain direction. So what to make of this model of a, that he describes Halachic Man? There's never been a posek in history who was halachic man, who was completely without any emotion. And even Rav Lichtenstein said, they have that story in there where on Rosh Hashanah, the Chabad Tokeya, he starts crying because the intensity of the moment, that Rav Moshe rebukes him, says, what does he say? Do you cry when you take a lulav? I mean, it's a mitzvah. And Rav Aaron said, quote, that this is over the top because, it's a mitzvah, but the Briskers were like that in certain respects. You've heard stories of the Briskers. If someone dies and it's Shabbos, they won't show any emotion. As soon as Shabbos is over, then they show the emotion. But the Rav, and that's maybe Revelvel, but we know Reb Chaim was not. Reb Chaim was full of emotion, and the Rav was full of emotion. If you read the way he describes his religious feeling. It's hard to know. You can ask experts on the Rav what to make of that. That image, there's even an argument. It's a crazy argument. It's completely, it can't be correct. But Moshe Sokol and David, I forget his name, who wrote in Modern Judaism, they claim that he's putting up this image of the Halachic Man to show, which he actually rejects that. It's something to be rejected. But anyone who knows how he felt about his father or grandfather, I don't know, unless the Rav made a distinction, as I said, between theoretical, what it, in this pure Platonic world, that's the posek. But in the real world, the here and now, there's no such a thing. And it would be really barbaric to imagine that a posek would not be moved by the plight of someone. If he sees a case where Ravad Yosef would stay up nights to free every Aguna after the Yom Kippur War, a posek who doesn't stay up, and a posek who's not, the posek who can't sleep, because of the mamzer, that's the true posek, the one who to its kishkas, he's forced. That doesn't mean he'll always be able to find the answer, but it has to affect him. Otherwise, it's just and it's true that someone sent me that there is a posek, a well-known posek whose attitude was completely different, and he trained himself so he had no emotional connection whatsoever, and he once even commented that it's like buttoning your shirt, you know, that, I think that was what he said. That should be, you know, when you see all these terrible cases, it should have no, it shouldn't touch you at all. And this is quoted by someone else saying that this is impossible. I think Rav Avram Shapiro actually quoted saying this is impossible. Rav Avram Shapiro took up smoking because he needed to calm himself down after being on the Beis Din to see these unbelievably difficult cases. So it is true, there is such a posek, but I don't believe that that's been the model of, and I don't believe it's human. Really, how can you see people's terrible stress and tragedies and not be moved by that? If you read the look in Chazal, the way they describe the role of the rabbis in situations like this, you see that they were moved by the gravity of the moment. So I think for that posek, it's just his personality. It's the exact opposite of what Rav Shlomo Zalman says. And he ends with this great story that from Rav Shlomo Zalman, that there was a case where in this yeshiva in Itri, maybe some of you are Itri yeshiva students, but this happened at the Itri yeshiva, and the minhag there was, as many of you might know, there's different practices on Kaddish. I haven't seen a shul that does this in a while, but there used to be many shuls where one person would say the Kaddish. each time, rather than as most places we do it, everyone who's an Avel will say the Kaddish. In my shul, they instituted a number of years ago that for one of the Kaddishes, if you have a Yortzeit, you're the only one who would say it. But in Itri, the minhag was that only one Avel would say every Kaddish. And so this student whose father died, he was learning there, and there was different discussions, like how to divide the Kaddishes. You know, one day one person would do it, another person would another do it. Rav Shlomo Zalman said, even though Rav Shlomo Zalman believed in keeping minhagim, not changing them, he said they should change the minhag of the yeshiva. And from now on, everyone should say Kaddish. And he explained why. He says, Ech targisha ima shel Talmud, Almana, how will the mother of this, the widow, the mother of this student feel when her son returns home and she asks him if he says Kaddish, and he says, yes, but, you know, only occasionally, because there's other people doing it. Lifamim, ani omer, but not always. My matzar shalomana, he says, how's his mother going to feel? His mother comes from a community where you have to say Kaddish every day. And this is her husband, his father. And Rav Shlomo Zalman felt, because of the way people are so emotionally connected to Kaddish, which we know is not a halacha, it's a minhag, but it's more important for people than halacha. It has such an emotional connection. He's going to tell his mother that he only says Kaddish maybe once a month. So Rav Shlomo Zalman said, here's an example where the regish, the feeling, is that they should change this minhag because the minhag is causing people to be upset and it's not halacha, so you can change it. So that's quite significant. There's a lot more to say, obviously, on the role of emotion and subjectivity, and you know, the posek getting not as an objective outsider, but someone joining together with the person to try to find a solution. But we must move on. But I think we're going to come back to that issue later on. We now move to page 202, Simon Pechet 88, Rav Avraham Yosef. And where's the books? We've spoken about Rav Avraham Yosef, but the tshuva revolves around something else. The tshuva we're going to look at now revolves around this man. And his name is Rabbi Yehuda Naki. So let me tell you about him. And I have to say that what I'm going to say to you is going to be scary for many of you. It's going to be very upsetting for many of you. And I don't write the books. I just report what's in them. When I say it's going to be scary, it's because we've had lots of cases of people abusing their positions of authority, including, unfortunately, rabbis abusing their positions of authority. And when you hear the story, which I'm going to read to you, you're going to be blown away as to how an answer like this could have been given. But let me give you an introduction, first of all. Rav Yehuda Naki, whose picture I showed you, let me get him up again. He was Rav Avadi Yosef's assistant. One of his assistants. He had a number of assistants for many years. And he would, over the years, people had questions to ask Rav Avadia. He would be the go-between. He also, once a week for a few hours, there was like an open house and people would come and they would ask questions of Rav Avadia Yosef, and he would stand on the side and he would write the answers down. And if they didn't feel they could formulate it, they would ask him and he would ask Rav Avadia Yosef and he would get the answer. And this went on for many years. And he published, I think it's 12 volumes, of this called Shelot Teshuvat Mayan Omer, which is, he says, what over many years, the tzibor, the community in my presence or through me would ask Rav Avadia Yosef questions. And these questions are written up, as I said, in the book. It looks like you have, I don't know if you can see at the top, question answer, very quick. You know, two-line question, one-line answer usually. At the most, it's maybe three lines answers. And at the bottom, he has all the notes that explains Rav Avadia's justification. And he says most of the questions are simple sort of questions. Nothing significant, just regular everyday sort of questions you would ask. Then he explains it. But some are more significant. and really questions of great interest. He says in the introduction to the book that you shouldn't use this for individual cases because every case could differ, but people do use it. It's cited a lot. I just opened it up. If you're in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei and you have to go to the bathroom, do you go back to when you return? Do you go back to where you stopped or go back to the beginning? And that's the sort of thing. Obviously, anyone could use that, a question like that. And there are some specific ones which you wouldn't. The book comes with an approbation by, among others, Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef, the Sephardic chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. And he writes about how Rabbi Naki has been together with, as the Mashamesh, the assistant with Maran, that's Ravad Yosef, for a number of years, already many years, he says, already when he was in Yeshivas Chazon Ovadia from 1982, when he began to serve as the assistant to Ravadia, and he goes on praising him, etc. Bear that in mind when you see how he throws him under the bus in a minute. But I have all the volumes because I try to get everything Ravadia has. Let me read you what appears in chapter 12, in volume 12. It's the last volume that has appeared. I believe the reason it's the last volume, let me just check just to confirm here. Yes, I'm looking at Otzer HaChachma and it shows it's the last volume. I believe it's the last volume because of what I'm going to show you right now and what we're going to discuss. And wait till you see what Rav Yitzhak Yosef said. Let me read this to you now. Hold on to your seats. This is page 127 in the new edition. It's page 128. It's in the section, Paraket, section dealing with Sniut, chapter question 5-7. A woman who had lung cancer went to a mekubal, and he said to her that in order for her to be healed, that he's going to give her the bracha or whatever he does, she has to undress. And perhaps also he'll have to touch her. And he sent her to Rav Avadi Yosef to get a heter for this. He told her that he has a heter from Rav Avadi Yosef, and Rav Avadi Yosef said he doesn't remember such a heter. So already, listen to the question. A woman has lung cancer, and the Makubal, or Makubal in quotes, says that in order for him to heal her, that she has to undress, and he might need to touch her. Now, before we even go further, I think it should be obvious to everyone that this is another example of what we spoke about in someone using an unsophisticated woman to try to have his way with her and everything. And at least that's what it would appear on the outside. I mean, what kind of Makubal needs a woman to undress and has to touch her to heal her? So, I mean, obviously this is why I'm going to write to Rav Avinu Yosef. And here comes the answer. And this is an answer, or at least Rav Naki reports this as Rav Avad Yosef stating it. Yecholah la'asot. She can do that. Aval im yitzarech ninigia, but if there needs to be touching between the mekubal and the woman, just what you need, like a glove. And Rav Avad Yosef told me, though, that this is because bikuach nefesh, aval hu atzma lo machzik bazeh, but he himself does not believe in this stuff. But the woman believes in it, and therefore it's permissible. And in the note, he explains the idea that if a doctor needs to do something, a doctor can do it. And here the Makubal is acting like a doctor, and therefore he can do it. Why does he need her to be undressed? He can't do his hocus pocus if she's not undressed. I don't know, but that's what he said. And Rav Avadia said, I don't hold this. And there is this idea already you have in the Rambam that even if something doesn't work, if the person thinks it works, it can help. But I mean, it's quite shocking, as you can imagine here. What's going on here? Well, before we even get to my question, here is the book of Rav Yitzhak Yosef. It's called Sheilot Tshuvot HaRishon LeTzion. This is Michtave Halachia, volume 2. And if you look at Simon in Evan Ezer, Simon Hay, page 404, he says as follows. I mean, he says that the regarding this woman who has cancer, she went to Makubal. The Makubal wants to do things that are forbidden from the Torah. And this author, remember, the author who was given a very good haskama, how great he was, how close he was to Rav Ovadia Yosef, this author said in the name of my father, and he quotes my father as saying that the woman could get undressed and stand this way before the Makubal. He says, Nora Nora Os, the Hasnil Haskir, and he closed Buki Striki Begonolam. He says, God forbid that my father could ever say such a thing. He never said such a thing. And he puts Makubal in quotes, to permit a woman to get undressed in front of a phony Makubal. But I have to say, this book was published, Mayan Omer was published in Rav Ovadia Yosef's lifetime. But that's what he says. And then he goes on, V'loni tena filo otzon al tag. We can't even consider this, even to raise this. It's so stupid. And all the more so not to write it on the book. And then he says, in his time, my father told me, Yisha Machaber HaNiskar, that this Machaber, Rabbi Yehuda Naki, who would walk with, would accompany him places, and he would ask him as they're going, and it wasn't always clear what he was asking, and he didn't always understand what Rav Ovadia meant. And it came out, Chorva created this terrible thing here. And when he would ask him questions between people and et cetera, et cetera. And then he concludes that this is a tos hamura. It's a terrible mistake. It can bring to terrible michsholim bisere daraisa. The heich got some michshol some tachasedo. How could such a stupid and terrible ruling? How could such a ruling ever have come out? And then he says he clearly doesn't know what he's talking about. That's Rav Yitzhak Yosef, and we can sympathize with Yitzhak Yosef. Because the ruling on the face of it is absurd. It's crazy. This idea of Mekubal in quotes, self-styled Mekubal, and we have to feel sorry for the people who go to them. But I wrote my letter to Rav Avraham Yosef, who was at the time Chief Rabbi of Cholon, before, although I made reference to this book in my book, before this book came about. I wrote in 2013. As soon as I saw this responsa, it made no sense to me. But let me also clarify that this, if you go on Otzer HaChachma or HebrewBooks.org, you will not see the responsa the exact way I just mentioned it. Because in the new edition, where it says in the original edition that in order to be healed, Tzrichal Hitpashet, she has to undress, in the new edition, it has in brackets, Ba'oto Makom. That is, if she has cancer here, she has to, in the lungs, let's say, so she has to just take off a little there. And so that's a big change. I still think, though, the whole idea, this book, the reason it became so accepted, was so popular, was because the author was regarded as reliable in that he was the assistant to Rav Ovadia, and it has the approbation of Rav Ovadia's son. When Rav Ovadia's son comes about, and as I said, throws him under the bus and says, you can't rely on him, etc., I think that's the reason why he stopped publishing, because but I wrote to Rav Avram Yosef, and I asked him, how could this be possible? Makes no sense at all. And he says as follows, regarding this question you asked me, he says it means to uncover that portion of the body which is injured, which has the cancer. That's what it's referring to. It's not so. He's saying exactly what appears in the second edition, which Rav Yehuda Naki, we have to say, wasn't careful what he wrote. But it's a mistake. From Rav Avraham Yosef's perspective, we'll see it's just a mistake. It's not that he was meaning to say something immoral and so terrible, but not on the entire body. Rav Avraham Yosef says, "Shazov vadi pritzut sholiyadat hakalkah," because this is clearly pritzut, immorality, and no one can permit this. Clearly, Rav Yehuda Naki was uncareful in his words, and what he wrote, undress, he didn't mean that. And then Rav Avraham Yosef says, "Since it's known to me regarding who the question was, and regarding this person, that is this Makubal, it's Mechay Gavra, Balacha Shayomer. It's known that his incantations have worked. Therefore, my father said, you can be lenient, but you can't learn from this to any other places." So Rav Avraham Yosef has a completely different perspective than his brother. Rav Avraham Yosef says that, no, this is a Makubal, even though Rav Avraham doesn't hold to this in general himself, people do hold of it. His blessings have seemed to work. And therefore, in this case, and clearly he was only talking about uncovering a certain part of the body, nothing sexual or anything like that, that would be a problem. Therefore, my father permitted it. And Rav Avraham Yosef says, I know the case. In other words, I know the person that's referring to, which Makubal, I guess there's a Makubal who says he can't give his lachash, his incantation or his blessing, unless he sees the bare skin for whatever reason. So I don't know what to make of all this. I wrote to Rav Avraham Yosef to clarify what's going on here. How can a Makubal or even a Makubal in quotes say such a thing? And how could Rav Avadia ever permit it? That was my question. He clarifies that no, it's referring to just a small portion, and it was thought that this Makubo is successful. Rav Yitzhak Yosef sees what I read you, the first version, as a proof that this author is terrible, and we can't cite from him, and he doesn't know what he's talking about, and you can't rely on him, and you get two different perspectives on the book Mayan Omer. If you read Rav Yitzhak Yosef, you can't rely on anything basically in it now, because he showed himself not to be reliable. You read Rav Avraham Yosef, no, it's I'll leave it to you. The only thing I want to add is that the idea that a Makubal should have to have any undressing, even of the whole thing, just strikes me as so inappropriate. And unless the Makubal could explain to me why he needs to see the actual skin, I would agree with Rav Yitzhak Yosef. You're dealing with a Makubal in quotation marks. And unfortunately, there have been many such Makubalim and Rebbe's. Rabbi Berland, put Rabbi in quotes, from Breslov, is one of them. There was that other Makubal in the religious Zionist world, I forget his name, who was very well known. David, I'm sure, knows who I'm talking about. Eisen knows who I'm talking about, with an S, I think his name was. We've had a lot of cases like that where people take advantage of their situation, and it's hard not to see this. But look, if you have from a different perspective and you believe in these Makubalim, that they can do certain things, maybe you shouldn't be asking questions. I don't know. So that's the tshuva. And there, as I said, Rav Avadia didn't hold to this, but he still, according to the book, said in this case, he permitted it. And look, I have no doubt that he was asked to uncover a little bit. Look, if you think it could help, maybe it could help. Psychosomatically, it could help. Who knows? We permit certain things. The Rambam says that you can recite incantations even on Shabbos, where it would be usher on Shabbos because it's Dvarim B'Tehillim. But even though it doesn't help, the person thinks it helps. You're allowed to, and the Rambam permits you to carry a kameya. Even if a kameya that has pagan connections to it, because if you think it can help you, like certain kameyas that would be used by idolaters and others, you can carry them because you think it can help you. Actually, no, I take that back. I don't recall the exact language if he says pagan, but he allows you to carry kameya that is of value because the people connected. If it's a avodah zarah, that's a different issue. But a kameya, he doesn't believe in it. He allows you to carry it, and you're not violating any issur or anything, because it can be valuable. So I have to see the exact Lashon again, the Rambam. It's a big problem because he speaks there about a Kameya that's been shown to be of value, but the Rambam doesn't believe it. So what it means is that people think it's of value. It's basically Kameyas that are old, amulets that are based on old wives' tales, not idolatry per se. He permits it. Okay, let's leave that. The next responsa is number 89. It's from this rabbi who we mentioned a couple times. I'm up here on the screen here. Passed away 2007. His name was Rav Menachem Chacham. And he was the Rav of Or Akiva. I looked today, it says that Or Akiva is the smallest city in Israel. I saw that on Wikipedia. I don't know and it's all Jewish, basically. I don't know the definition of a city in Israel to know what makes it, but it's the smallest, 15,000 residents of all different sorts. And this never appeared in his book. It's published here for the first time. And really, it should have been earlier in the book because it deals with the same question that was earlier. We put it here and then it was too complicated to change it. The title of it is Chovat Yachsut B'Chavod L'Chachamim L'Deatem B'Mkom Machloket. How to relate, the question we discussed with Rav Henkin, Rav Avinair, how do you relate to rabbis who treat others disrespectfully? And I wanted to know his opinion, in particular, the Satmar Rebbe. So he writes to me the same sort of idea we've seen before. First of all, he says, who am I to put my head into these disputes? He quotes the Gemara that says that the Gemara mentions in Yevamos that they asked Rabbi Yeshua a question. He says, this is the dispute between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Mipnei ma'atem machlisim roshi bein shnei harim gedolim. You're putting me between them? And then he gives a little bit of his biography that he, in his youth, he learned in Koisenberg. And he got smicha from a Satmar Chassid in Koisenberg. And but yet he's not now. I mean, he's not Satmar in his philosophy. And he goes and speaks about, you know, how we have to judge everyone favorably, et cetera, et cetera. He even says, he says towards the end, he says that I'm a rabbi here in Or Yehuda. There's 13 different kehilot. He says Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Moroccans, Taimanim, Tripoli, those who come, Tunisians. People come, Spaniolim, Sfarad, from the Caucasus, the Indians, Hungarian, Polanin, Romanin, those who come from Russia. He says, I love them all. Every child gets from me a blessing and an ashika. And basically, his point was what we saw with Ravimir, that we shouldn't be involved with this. We should respect everyone. We shouldn't get involved in any of these disputes. Okay. We can expect that. That's nothing. And then at the end, though, he gets to a different question. I had also asked him a question about in marriage, Tabat Zu or Zo. And even though he comes from Hungary and he's a real Ashkenazi, he actually says it's Tabat Zo. And that's, he says, real good Sidurim have it, Harim Gachli, but Tabat Zo. And then he points out something else, which I had never thought of. We just said Geshem, but God willing, we'll say Tal. He points out the following. Is it? Here. In the bracha of Tal, the first day of Pesach, right at the beginning, I have my art scroll sitter here. I'll read you. You can see it here. It says, Bedato Abiyachidot. Art scroll translate. With his consent, I will speak of mysteries. Then it says, right here, Ba'amzu, Bezu, Betal Hachadot. Translation here, among this people, through this prayer, may they be made exultant by the dew. So Ba'amzu, like Amzu Ga'alta, with this nation, that means it's playing on it, Amzu Ga'alta, not Amzes. I think Amzu, the nation which we will, etc., etc. But then it says Bezu. But what is Bezu referring to? Bezu is referring to the prayer, and Art Scroll even has it in brackets. So, Ba'am Zu, among this people, Bezu, through this prayer, may they be exalted by the Jew. So, if you're talking about tefillah, it has to be feminine. So, Rabbi Chacham says you have to read it, Ba'am Zu, Bezu, Betal HaChadot. And just before I checked Korin has Bezu. So any of you who are chazanim and you want to be careful on it, that's what you can do. Ad Khan. So we've ended the section of the book dealing with issues in Pesach Halacha. Now we get to a section of the book, and here we'll start with Menashe Klein right now. It's called Dat Umedina, religion and state, and not just Israel, but also America, how religion deals with the state. And the first responsum, which we'll be able to finish, I believe, is number 90. It's where Menashe Klein put into three parts, was originally one letter, but here's the second part, right after he spoke about how he doesn't want to read Rabbi Drach's article. Let's get Rabbi Drach's article up, because it's in English, and he doesn't believe in Torah literature being in English. Then he gets to the heart of the issue. So here's... Okay, there's Rabbi Drach. Actually, I see this here. I wanted to show you because I forgot to mention this, after I told you the story with Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler, unfortunately for him, he was only a rabbi. He wasn't a grand rabbi. If you notice, bunch of rabbis sent letters to Trump, and in the stationery, they're all called grand rabbis. So you have grand rabbi. I don't know how it is that the translation of a Rebbe became Grand Rabbi. So I guess, Rav Aaron Cutler, he was very political. So he would sign a lot of Kol Koris. He would sign with these Hasidic Rebbes. They each were called Grand Rabbi. And he was only a rabbi. The Gadol Hador is called Rabbi. And all these others, they're called Grand Rabbis. I always find that strange. But here's the article. And thank you, Martin, for pointing out this was written. I thought it was the early 90s, as I recall. It wasn't. You could see already, he's Rabbi Boca Raton Synagogue. This is 1986, actually. And this is the article I sent to Rabbi Klein, The Ethics of Selecting a Political Candidate, very much in Yana Dioma. Begins, does the halacha permit a Jew to vote for a candidate for public office who is committed to a policy that is in violation of the halacha? Very interesting question. Interesting analysis. I recommend everyone to read this because it is not, as I said last week, almost all the articles in this journal will just be a summary of different opinions, and that's it. He makes an argument, he cites things, and his conclusion, which I wanted Rabbi Klein at the time, I thought there were problems in his argument, although practically I see it makes sense, but I thought there were issues in it, and I wanted Rabbi Klein to deal with it. He concludes that, we may now summarize, even were we to assume that a candidate ran solely on the platform of legalized abortion on demand, he used that as an example of something that would be against Jewish law, but the candidate is running as a pro-choice candidate, and would therefore, if elected, potentially be in violation of the Noahide commandment to establish laws. That is, the Noahides are commanded to establish laws not in violation of the Noahide code, of which abortion is. A vote in his behalf would be permissible. And then he explains why it's permissible. And then he goes further and says that candidates don't run on one-issue platforms. So it's not even a question of, he was arguing even if it's a one-issue, but it's not a one-issue. A vote for a candidate who advocates legalized abortion is also a vote for one who supports many permissible and preferred positions. One would therefore be permitted to vote for him, leaving aside the abortion issue, because you can make a case that at the end of the day, the choice is not between Jewish law and not Jewish law, it's between pro-life and pro-choice. And the pro-life position would ban abortions that Jewish law feels are permissible, according to many great poskim. So that's why... usually you don't, even the Aguda argued, put in an opinion that in favor of, against the pro-life, in favor of pro-choice position in one of the court cases, because the only way to guarantee that Jews would be able to have abortions when Jewish law permits it, you can't have a law that says when Jewish law permits it, you can do it. It's either going to be permissible or not permissible. When I say permissible, obviously I don't mean up until the ninth month, but under certain restrictions. So therefore, you have many, many great rabbis who hold that the pro-choice position is the position that should be advocated precisely because that's the only position that we can be sure that Jewish law will be followed. And if other peoples have abortions, that's not our concern, even if they have it for their own reasons. But leaving that aside, he argues, in any event, that there's all sorts of reasons, technical reasons, why you don't have to be concerned with these matters. The candidate will not personally perform the objectionable activity. He's not doing it by himself. Candidates run on multi-issue platforms, et cetera, et cetera. So in short, what Rabbi Drach's argument is that in these matters, you might be interested. You might feel that this abortion is so important a matter to you that you don't want to support this candidate who permits abortion. But that's not what Rabbi Drach was asking about. He's not asking about what position you're inclined to and what you feel comfortable. He was saying, halachically, can we say that, can you make a declaration that it is forbidden to vote for candidate X because they advocate a position, gay marriage, abortion, whatever it is, that's in opposition to Jewish law? And Rabbi Drach's argument is no. So I wanted to know from Rabbi Klein what his position is. Does he accept this argument? And he begins by saying that this is a very difficult question, and it's hard to give an answer for a few reasons. He says, first of all, non-Jews, it's not just you're going to vote. I mean, non-Jews are also, and you're doing your own thing, non-Jews are also obligated. So we don't want to create a situation where the non-Jews are not following Jewish law. And he speaks about that. And then he says, he speaks about the differences between Jewish law and non-Jewish law, that non-Jews are obligated to enforce things. So we want to have such a society. And there's a, you'd say there could be lif ne'iv here. That is that we're putting a stumbling block. We're electing people who are not going to, and he says, not just a non-Jew, but a non-religious Jew. We're creating a situation where they're being responsible to, for violating laws that they're obligated in. And that's how, that's Siman 90. Now he splits up 90 to 91, even though it's the same question. 90 is, can you vote for someone to the government who's certainly gonna do things against the Torah? And the next one he divided it is, if you're involved in the elections, therefore, and you vote for these people, are you, responsibility if they then institute things against Jewish law? Really, it's one question. He split it up. It's just a continuation. But since it's already just about 9:30 and he split it up, we'll begin next week with the question, can his position, Moshe Klein's position, and it's not just halacha, he gives a whole hashkafic position, which is going to be, I think, very much at odds with all of us listening here. It's definitely at odds with the people who drove yesterday from Brooklyn and Long Island in the Jews for Trump rally, if you saw that. And it's definitely not at odds with what you see today, even in the most Haredi communities, with their Trump flags and their very much their political involvement. It's interesting to see whether this is the beginning of a real even Haredi strong identification politically, like we haven't seen before. We'll see he has a completely different perspective on this, more of a Golis mentality. And then we'll get to his position on halacha, which diverges from Rabbi Drach, though without a clear argument, I think, to refute Rabbi Drach, but we'll get to that. And then we have all sorts of other interesting things we will get to next class. But let me end here. We covered a lot of ground, and let me take some of the questions and the comments. The questions and the comments, people have emailed me. They think this is the most interesting part at the end with the questions and the comments. So thank you. Howard says, do you postulate in accordance with majority? What happens if someone in a minority has a better svar? Well, in the kuntras I have, it says that if you're a Talmud Chacham, you can decide on your own that the person with the in the minority has a better svar. You can go by him. But for the masses, he says you have to go by the majority in Doraisa. In Darabanan, you can you don't have to go by the majority. You can go by the minority, which has the problems I mentioned. First of all, that means you don't need rabbis anymore. Why do you need a posek? He himself raises the question. Why would you ask your local posek? If you know that of the great authorities, the majority are machmir, it's a Doraisa, what do you get by asking your local posek? It's still going to be the majority. So he doesn't answer that question, and he seems to imply you don't even need the posek anymore, because today we have books. If it's an individual case, you need a posek, because that's. But in terms of just knowing the halacha, he seems to be saying you don't need to ask a posek. What do you need a posek for? That's these are already settled law. So that's, and also I said, it seems that this is not how Jewish people have behaved. Ramosha Feinstein, if he was the majority, if he was the minority, it didn't matter. If he was the poseg, we relied on him, even if it's a Torah matter. It could be, he says that the Mishnah Berurah, you can rely on him, even in my, he's the minority, because we've accepted him, just like we've accepted Shulchan Aruch. Okay, well, once you use that argument, you can say we've accepted Ramosha. It's a, he raises a lot of issues. He doesn't answer them all. Someone emails, texts privately that Rav Hirshel Schechter said the opposite. The poseg always had independence. No, no, he thinks the poseg has independence too, but that's not just for the poseg and his immediate students. But if you're just a regular person, there'd be no reason like to ask Rav Hirshel Schechter a question. Why would you ask him? You're asking him, you don't need to ask him. You look in the sources, you see what the majority is. And if the majority is one way, if Rav Schechter is lenient, how does that change matters? Of course, that's not how we work. In the modern Orthodox world, usually, if Rav Schechter says it, maybe we say we've accepted him to a certain extent. I don't know. But I never thought of this point that this rabbi raises, that today with technology and the spread of books, the poseg's job is really only to deal with complicated matters that affect individuals. But as a general question, like you're asking, can you use a tea bag on Shabbos or something, or a klisheni or a klishlishi? That you can find your own answer, and there's no reason to even ask the poseg, because what's the difference? You still have to find out what the majority and minority is, unless you're a Talmud Mufak, in which case you can go by him in any case. But he says most people don't have that sort of relationship. I don't know. Think about that, because the rabbis are not going to be too happy with that position, and I don't think they accept it, because it basically means that your local pulpit rabbi, who serves as like a poseg, when people have questions about Shabbos and things, I guess if you don't know any better, you can ask him. But if you know a little, you know how to research, there's no point in asking. Baruch says that he was the official Baal Kori of Chabad. He was the official Baal Kori, the rabbi who read it, exactly. I never implied that the Rebbe would lean differently if he leaned. If such matters are important, then would he not correct his official Baal Kori? My assumption is it's not important. That is, even though you're supposed to read Vayihi, if you read Vayihi, it's not such a big deal. Like the Rebbe might have even said, we've been doing it for hundreds of years, so now that becomes acceptable. I don't know what the Rebbe would have said, but we know that not everything is so important. You can speak properly, and maybe you want to. It's Lashon HaKodesh, but it doesn't change the meaning or anything like that. So I'm not at all assuming that it's important. Susanna says, Kol and Tanakh says, Kol. I don't know what you mean when it says Kol Atzmotai. In Koran Tanakh, it has a kamatz. It does not have a kamatz katan there, if you look in the Koran. It'll have a regular kamatz.
No, it has a kamatz katan. The new Koran Tanakh.
On Kol Atzmotai?
Yeah.
If it does it, it's a mistake. If you look in the Koran Siddur, it does not have it. And if you are you holding it in front of you right now?
I
take a look. You will not have it. You will not have it. And if it has it, it's a mistake.
The Koran Siddur I don't have, but the Koran
Tanakh. No, if you look in the Koran Tanakh, it will not have it. It's Kal. It's not. And if it is, it's a mistake, which by then they've corrected. I found a mistake in the Simanim. There's no Makath in that. So by definition, it can't be. And that's what you heard. And all the I emailed my friend today. The Syrians also say, why do they get it right? Why do the Syrians get it right? Why the Moroccans? Why everyone? Because they, not that they know diktuk they know diktuk and we don't. It's because they recite it all out loud. So everyone in the Syrian and Moroccan community grows up reciting this out loud. So they hear it said, kal. That's how they know it's kal. But if you never hear it recited out loud, you're going to assume it's kol. And it's not that different for Ashkenazim because already we say kol, so kol. But if you're raised in the American modern Orthodox system where it's Sephardic pronunciation, like my son, then you can't pronounce that kol. You have to pronounce it kol. By the way, take a picture and send that to me of the Koran Tanakh because, I don't have Koran here. This is,
I don't have that kind of phone.
I don't have Koran here. I have Leningrad, and he doesn't distinguish. Here. Koran Siddur here. And I'll give you the page numbers here. If you look in Shacharit LeShabbat, see in the Koran Siddur, it distinguishes. So for example, it begins Nishmat Kochai, and you could see it's a much bigger Kamatz. And then you go, yes, so I don't know if you could see this, but I'm wrong. I was looking at a different sitter. This does not have, this has it as a Kamatz, you're right, this has a Kamatz Katan. It's a mistake. It's an absolute mistake. I'm looking at the Koran Siddur. It absolutely is a mistake here. It has it as a Kamatz. It has it as a Kamatz Katan, but it's not a Kamatz Katan. It's so this is a mistake that Koran needs to be told about if anyone has any connection to them. I will show you a different Siddur I have here. There's two times that it's a Kamatz Gadol, Kol, in Tanakh, and then there's another time where it is, but it doesn't mean all. It's the word, it means to measure, and that's also a different word.
In the Haftarah somewhere, it's a verb.
Yeah, it's a verb. It's not a noun. It's a verb. And it's the word Kol, as we know it, is from Kalal. Let me show you one more thing before we go on here. You'll be able to see it, I think. Well, I don't know if you can see it. So here's the Siddur.
It's blurry.
It's blurry. Okay. No, it's definitely, it's a Kamatz Gadol. And I thank you for doing that. Well, the Siddur I checked before, I have a different Siddur, not a Koran, which distinguished it. This is a mistake. 100% it's a mistake. As you heard it, they pronounce it right. It's Kamatz. And okay, thank you for that, Suzanne. I'm sorry for doubting it. David says, apropos the story of Moshe Soloveitchik and the Baal Tokeya, together with Shlomo Zonnerbach and Emotion, a similar story took place in Kol Torah, told in Halicha Shlomos concerning a student who saw another student crying during Zacchaeus and sarcastically asked him, do you also cry when you say Asher Yatzar? This exchange was told to Shlomo Zonnerbach and greatly angered him, and prompted him to publish a letter to the entire yeshiva explaining why there is no comparison and there certainly is room for displaying emotion during a tzakios as opposed to when saying Asher Yatzar. Thank you for that, David. In this book that I read you the section about Rav Aaron Cutler before, he also deals with that, and he quotes one of the Gedolim, I forget who, it might have been Ryaka Kamenetsky, saying that the whole story doesn't make any sense to him because the Rambam describes what's the point of Tzkiyas HaShofar. It's supposed to bring us to tshuva and call us to attention. So it's not like Asher Yatzar, and it's not like taking a lulav. It has a specific emotional moment when you blow the shofar that the Rambam himself describes it. So he couldn't understand why Ramosha got that way. Mel says, in Beis HaTalmud in Bensonhurst, only one person says Kaddish. That's the old way, incidentally. That is maybe the authentic way. Rabbi Kelman says he's in the middle of reading Rabbi Sperber's new book on the community rabbi, and his theme is that a posek must be super sensitive. He brings in source after source. I haven't seen the book yet. I would have to. Susanna points out that the Kabbalist can't see the tumor, so what's the why can he do it over the clothes? It's a question. It's a good question. And someone privately points out that the next question, tshuva in Mayan Omer, is also problematic, and I didn't get into that. That's also dealt with by in just a few lines by Rav Yitzhak Yosef. I could send it to the person who asked about this. He gets into that as well. Baruch says that Rav Shusterman was asked to teach Dikduk in Lubavitch. I can tell you that in the in his Torah reading, he always pronounces it Mila'el, Mila'ra properly. It could be that they didn't hold that in our day and age, it's important to know Shvanah, Shvanach. Rabbi Weider, he pronounces every Dagesh exact. Who does that? You know, Dagesh Chazak. Who pays attention to that? But he does. He pronounces every chirik differently, if it's a long chirik or short chirik. These are the sort of extra things. It could be Roy Schusterman did not believe, but I can tell you, you can look at his video when he pronounces it Ritzfat, and that's not true. But you don't need to correct it, but it's a shvana. Okay. Yezu asher, amzu galta, amasher galta. Okay. Howard tells us he'd accepted many saying Kaddish together, but he can't accept is when we have real yesomim, brothers or unrelated, under bar mitzvah, the adults find it necessary to drown them out and not let them say Kaddish after Aleinu alone, especially when these boys cannot daven for the omen and be motzi to klal. It's a good point. I understand that for children, sometimes you have a real orphan, a young child, and is drowned out. And in my shul, as I said, they kept that one Kaddish after Aleinu for the yort site. And it could be, I guess, for the young people if we needed to. Mel says that another issue of the Journal of Halacha will be coming out soon. I don't need to mock the Journal of Halacha. I just, in terms of reading, if you know a little bit about Halacha, you're left wanting, because all you do is you read it, many of the articles, and you got a lot of sources. So you got this source says this, and this source said that. So you've been given information, but you've maybe learned some facts, but you haven't been enlightened. That was my point. Rabbi Dratch's article was different than the others. There were some others like his, but the overall majority is you were never enlightened. You never actually, there was never an argument. There was never someone trying to make a point independently. There never was someone trying to actually come up with an original idea. It was just a summary of these Achronim said this, these Achronim said that. Oh, and I asked Rav Kamenetsky and he said this, and I asked that, and that's okay. It's a lot of sources. You can get that in Avad Yosef too. In Breuer's, only one person says Kaddish, I'm told privately. That is, every day a different person says Kaddish, if you can type it in again. I'll wait for that final and then we'll end. If you can just type it in, Breuer's, you know, the Breuer's community, they keep their minhagim. So the private text I have here is that Breuer's only one person says Kaddish. They're distributed now and get distributed to different individuals. That was the old Ashkenazic practice, actually. The Chasam Sofer mentions it even. I'm not sure how it is. Well, that was the old German practice. I think the practice we all have comes from Poland. But the original Nusach Ashkenaz from Frankfurt, it was one person saying it. Look, Roshom Zalman Auerbach says today, I think he would say that even all our shuls today, someone texts me that the practice we have is based on Napoleon. I don't know, have to look into that. I understand though. But I don't know, we'll end with this. Roshom Zalman held, despite, even if this was the better way, the original way, today people's feelings are hurt. If you tell them that they can't say Kaddish, and you tell a mother that her son can't say Kaddish for his father and for her husband. And Rav Shlomo Zalman said that sometimes regesh, feeling, needs to... I'll say one more thing before we end. The Rav Avram Dov Ber Kana Shapiro came to America. And because the whole idea of Kaddish is... I mean, if you miss a Kaddish, you can do Mishnayos, you can do other things. It's not halacha, it's halacha mishmisinai, but it's become so significant. Wieseltier wrote a book on Kaddish, Samuel Heilman. Thank God I haven't had to say it, but everyone who has knows it's very meaningful in a way that strict halacha is not. I think it's an incredible thing that it's so meaningful, something which is not halacha. It shows, I guess it helps prove Heschel's point that we shouldn't be pan-halachic and not everything should focus on halacha. We can have very meaningful things which aren't halachic, which arise from minhag. And that's also an important point because therefore when people suggest certain reforms and you can say, well, what's wrong with the reform? It's not against halacha. And the point is, again, we're not only about halacha. There's a lot of things we do that are not halacha, but are important. Rav Avraham Dov Ber Shapiro was with Revel, and I don't know if he was giving a shiur or whatever, and he said, I have to go because I have to go say Kaddish. And Revel said to him, Revel said he had to leave. Revel had to say Kaddish, and the Rav Avraham Dov Ber Shapiro said to him, you too? In other words, this came from Revel's widow. Rekefet reported this, that Rav Avraham Dov Ber Kana Shapiro was actually surprised that Rabbi Revel thought it was necessary for him to get to every single Kaddish. I mean, if he said Kaddish in the morning at Shacharis, right now he's giving a, let's say the Kovner Rav is giving a shir. Why is it so important for Rabbi Revel to leave? So he can get the minion, so he can say Kaddish, he can tell him the Echidus later. And Rav Avram Dovber Kana Shapiro was surprised that a Talmud Chacham like Rabbi Revel thought it was important to catch every minion for the Kaddishes. This is a personal thing. I've been with people, Talmud Chachamim, who thought it was enough to just get one Kaddish, you know, the Shacharis. They weren't so makpid. Others are makpid all the time. But that's the fact that Rabbi Kana Shapiro thought this was more of like for the masses, that you have to do all, but we're learning Torah, so we don't need to do all those Kaddishes. Rabbi Revel thought differently. I'll just end, just because you're sending it in, and then we'll have to say goodnight. That one of you texts privately, the Mishnah Berurah has a full kuntras about who says Kaddish, who has precedence, not only the Chasam Sofer, the Aruch HaNer, etc. Baruch says Rosh Hashanah Zalman Rabach is not the final word. I never said he's the final word. Never said he's the final word, but he was influential, very influential. And in the state of Israel, he was really the only posek in his day who was considered authoritative in both the religious Zionist world and in the Haredi world, much like his son-in-law. But Rosh Hashanah Zalman Rabach was in both worlds. And finally, from Baruch, Yosef Ometz says that it's actually, you're saying Rabbi Han, right? It's pronounced, as I recall, Yosef Ometz. That's the proper way to say it, Baruch. Says that learning Torah is seven times more powerful, better than Kaddish. Seven times more powerful. Kaddish is for the Amaratzim. But the Talmid Chachamim are supposed to learn. Rabbi Harlap says something similar as well. And Howard, someone texts me, yes, I'm right, it's Yosef Ometz. Okay, and David points out the word for Yishai in Haftarah of Yishai is Vekayeh and Vekaveh. Yes, that is true. But we can go on forever. I want to thank you all again. I hope to see you all next week with more very interesting stuff. Keep sending me. I promise, believe it or not, that all the people who have sent me, I printed it out. I will get to them, the ones I told you as I get to. I can't get to everyone because then we'll never go forward. But I told a number of you I'll discuss it, including Mal, Yiskadel versus Yiskadal, and Yehuda, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get to that, God willing. We're not ending next week, so we have time to get to it all. Okay, Rabbi Kelman, just some final words.
Thank you. No final words. Just we look forward to seeing you next week. This week, of course, tomorrow, we don't have our 11 a.m. shir. We're going to have the Hillim class, Dr. Gesundheit. That's at 12:15 tomorrow. Hope you can come. He's quite a creative thinker. Those of you who have been there, an extremely creative thinker. It's an understatement. And we'll be starting either next week or the week after an introduction to Midrash on Tuesday morning by Simi Peters. I just announced it for the first time this morning. We haven't even sent out an email. So that will go into our sort of 11 a.m. slot. And then the rest of the week, Wednesday in the morning, and then 8 p.m., not 8:30 at night, our share on the Haftorah of the week. And then Thursday morning and evening. And we look forward to seeing you. And everybody have a wonderful night and be safe and be well. And Laila Tov, Laila Tova.
Laila Tov.